Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. I am sitting here alongside my compadre, Mr. Bob Hoban, and we are talking about the trials and tribulations of a cannabis economist. We're joined by no one better to speak on this subject than the founder of Whitney Economics, Mr. Bo Whitney. Bo, thank you for being here with us this evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for sure.
And I say trials and tribulations because with an emerging market, an emerging industry like the hemp and marijuana sectors are, I can imagine that the job of an economist is a little more difficult than in a mature industry where we have complex reporting, complex accounting of the supply chain. Just give us a sense here. Do you think trials and tribulations is an accurate depiction of what it's like to be a cannabis economist?
I think it's spot on. There's just the thing that makes it a little bit of a challenge is the lack of data, reliable data out there, the lack of harmonized data sets from federal governments and the like. And so it really requires a person like me to delve into it, really get boots on the ground, talk to people constantly, and really assess what's going on. But having been in the industry now for 7 years, I've built up enough of a knowledge base to where I can predict what's going on with a fair degree of accuracy.
Let's talk a little bit about that background that makes you so well suited to take on that challenge. Tell us a little bit about your background before the cannabis industry.
Yeah, before I delved into cannabis, I was doing two roles. One, I was involved in the supply chain and doing applied forecasting, applied economics in the semiconductor industry, first at Intel and then at Qorvo. And then I was also teaching economics at the university level. And that background, especially in the supply chain side, I brought into the cannabis space initially as a consultant and then as the chief operations officer of a vertically integrated cannabis company here in Oregon.
You know, Bo, you and I, we've known each other for several years now, and frankly, we've traveled the world together, if you think about it. We've been together in places like Panama and Zimbabwe, of all places, near Victoria Falls, and I think Israel and a couple of other places for certain. And you did a lot of work for many years with New Frontier Data. And what did you learn in that process that applies now just about the inconsistency of the information that underlies the data? And how do you mine appropriate data that can help people make good decisions in this context?
Yeah, we have traveled the world together. And just to think even 7 years ago that I would be traveling around the world talking about cannabis, it blows my mind, to be quite frank. What my experiences at New Frontier did was, and I'm really grateful for the experiences I had there, it took me from being a regional analyst, a specialist on, say, the West Coast cannabis in the U.S., and it took me to become more of a national and international figure. And it gave me that exposure to the entire market. So I'm really quite grateful for that. The thing where I've differentiated myself, and I started this at New Frontier and I've continued it on with my firm, is a lot of the data people tell stories about is backward looking. Where the value in the data is actually is in what does that data mean for the future of cannabis. So I've been able to develop that skill, the predictive tools and the like, in order to project what does the data mean in the future, what does the data now mean for the future? And I think people have really grasped onto that, seen the work that I've done, developed that body of work, and now with those predictive tools, people really have reached out to me on a pretty consistent basis.
Now, when you talk about data, of course, there's multiple sectors to our industry. There's the quote-unquote marijuana sector, of course, which revolves around adult use and or medicinal states and those sort of intrastate commerce. That has been additionally made more complex by the fact that it's global in scope now and that we see products quite literally moving across the supply chain on an international basis. And then you've got industrial hemp. And I know you split your time in terms of your analyses between those different sectors. And the industrial side, of course, is not limited to industrial uses of the industrial hemp plant, but rather includes cannabinoids and extraction technologies and commerce in different places, all against the backdrop of not having uniform regulations. So how on earth do you begin? Because you came at these things when there really was no pathway or pattern. Certainly there were methodologies that were utilized in other fields, methodologies that you were trained in your education and training. But how do you even go about gathering data in something that's brand new? When you look at the marijuana sales in the marijuana sector, that was challenging, but also somewhat definable. How do you look at something brand new like CBD when New Frontier began to put out some of the first reports, presumably with your input and deep participation on CBD and cannabinoids? How do you even begin to go about gathering information that's indicative of market trends and pricing?
Some of the tools that served me quite well was not only looking at the data that was available in the normal institutions of the federal government and like, but also to utilize survey data and to then follow up on that survey data and talk to people. And then to try to triangulate some of the observations from one data set into another. And once you are able to triangulate that, then there's a compelling story to tell. Those interviews post-survey have been really critical for me, because you always get a nugget out of each and every conversation that you have. Each participant has a story, and those stories are worth telling and airing and exploring. So it's been through the use of some of the data that's out there standardized, and then extrapolating using some of the survey data as well. And then I've also, in some instances, I've asked some of the questions that's a little bit atypical of your standard economist. I've been more focused on the business of things and what does the data mean from a business perspective. And that's been really valuable, so that people can answer questions about their business, leverage not only the data from a theoretical economics perspective, but then take that data and apply it to their day-to-day operations. And that's really what separated me from the rest of the pack.
As Bob pointed out, the industry is now global in scope. And I had a question that came to mind when you used the word predictive. And this is, I guess, more so a question related to the hemp side of the industry. But there are other places in the world, other regions, where there is a more mature market for this commodity. And I'm thinking about Europe on the industrial hemp side. I'm thinking a lot about Canada on the hemp grain side. And in your journey of trying to make sense of what's going on in the United States around the industrial hemp supply chain and where the market is at, the economics of it, how important or not important has it been to look at these other more mature markets internationally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my approach has been to look at these markets from an example perspective, and then look at the differences between Europe, between Canada, between the U.S., and then account for those differences in my modeling. The environment right now in the United States, especially on the industrial side, is so nascent. So while there's parallels between these more mature markets, you really have to account for that nascent stage of the U.S. market and then work from it within that. And there's actually a fair amount of data, especially on licenses, especially on number of processors, number of growers in the space, number of acres. If one looks at that from a business perspective and then uses that data to model out, combining that with surveys, then there's a lot of information actually about the U.S. market.
You know, one thing that holds up market development, of course, is regulation and or legislation, legality, in fact. And when you're talking about the marijuana sector, certainly that's challenging, but there are signs that the Democrats in charge here in the United States, of course, would move forward in some kind of cannabis legalization or perhaps regulatory reform. But the same thing applies on the CBD side or on the industrial hemp side, considering that there really aren't concrete regulations that are uniform from the FDA in that instance concerning CBD as an ingredient. When you talk about being predictive and analyzing and suggesting what will happen next, how does the regulatory environment, in your opinion, affect the pricing and the stability? Because if I'm using an economic model 2 years ago on CBD, for example, the pricing combined with the distribution outlets was substantially different than it is today when we've got an oversupply and a lack of regulations and a lack of uniform and standardized distribution outlets. And I think the same thing in part can be said for the marijuana sector. We have intrastate commerce. We have limited commerce that's mostly vertically integrated depending on which state you go to. And all of those things create artificial market restrictions. How do you predict what's going to happen next and when it's going to happen? How do you create and build those things into a model so that somebody cannot just say, when it's legal, we're going to have billions of dollars worth of revenue? How do you anticipate those changes and build models around them?
When I look at the higher THC side of the ledger versus the industrial side, it seems as though each market is one will advance past the other, and then the other will catch up and go past. And right now, I think hemp is in the lead from just a market perspective. And the reason I say that is because it's federally legal. There's interstate commerce and the like, but that doesn't mean that it's without its challenges. Right now, that regulatory uncertainty is one of the greatest existential threats to the market. And what the federal regulations or the murkiness associated with them is doing is it's creating enough uncertainty to create risk aversion in the eyes of these investors. And it creates uncertainty around product deployment and development. Whereas on the higher THC side, because it's siloed in nature, you understand the rules of a given state, even though there's this overhang of the federal illegality. Right now, though, what I've been focused on is providing inputs and educational materials into Congress on 280E tax reform, banking, and interstate commerce. I feel like those are the areas that if you make incremental change, there can be a great deal of positive benefits to the market. When it comes to predictions, what I do is I look at each one of these issues that are creating these existential threats, and then I account for them and say, if A happens, then the result will be X, and if B happens, then the result will be Y. And it's just by demonstrating this connectivity and cause and effect that people can then make decisions based on data and some of the insights as well.
That's a great point. And one of the things that we have heard just time and time again on the Hoban Minute podcast is governments becoming more interested in the high THC product and creating a pathway to legalization because of the economic stimulus that it may bring in a post-COVID world. You pair that with the very positive year that Colorado had in cannabis sales. It seems that Oregon also had a very good year for sales, and you have to ultimately come back if the federal government in our country or governments around the world are really interested in the economic potential of this industry. They're going to want to see some real data to support it beyond what we've seen enough of in this industry, which is just people talking about how great it is. Let's put some real numbers in front of politicians and political figures and decision makers to help them get incentivized. And it did sound like what you were just commenting on as well, as far as the tax reform, the 280E, it could be addressed a little bit in the Safe Banking Act. And while we haven't really spoken a lot about some of the updates we've seen here in the past couple of weeks, the way that Senate Majority Leader Schumer and others seem to be very supportive of that legislation, all of that just makes a compelling case for the work that you do in providing this kind of data so that our decision makers can make decisions.
Well, you know, Eric, to that point, and Bo, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. when you think about it, it's not sufficient to go in and go, come on, guys, this is a plan that has 50,000 uses. And look at what's happening. There's a great demand and all of these things are just so obvious. That's not obvious to the rest of the world, which is why data matters so much. And if I recall correctly, I think on the last day of one of the events in Zimbabwe, you were caught up in a number of meetings with government officials from different jurisdictions across the African continent. There were folks from Rwanda and Uganda and Zimbabwe and Eswatini and many other places. How much value or how willing were they to receive the value from the data that you guys worked so hard to put together? Is that critical in their minds or do they just implicitly think that, yep, this is going to solve our economic woes?
Oh, no. A majority of my work right now is on outlining and educating on the economic development and the economic potential of both medical adult use and industrial cannabis. In my experiences in Africa, what they were interested in were the benefits that could be derived from hemp or the higher THC medical side of things, the job creation, the reduction of healthcare expenditures, the tax revenues, and the opportunities to open up new international markets. And so they were highly interested in that, but they had never really been walked through what it would take in order to accomplish those goals of economic development, job creation, taxes, and the like. And that's why it was so rewarding to go there and to talk about this, show them the models, and demonstrate the true potential of the market. I think there were two aspects of that which were most rewarding. One, I mentioned to the president's attaché of Zimbabwe, I said, some of your taxation schemes and ownership schemes are a little bit counterproductive to the development of the market, and take some of those tax monies and apply them to schools and build schools. And that really resonated with him. He said, I'll take that to the president tomorrow. I was somewhat skeptical that he actually would, but in fact, I confirmed with him directly that he did. And they're looking at using tax money from cannabis in order to build schools in Zimbabwe and elsewhere. That was extremely rewarding. And so it's issues like that that make this not just talking about adult use medical or industrial. It talks about how cannabis can impact society in so many different ways than just from a dollars and cents perspective.
Now, that's really good perspective, and we've wanted to have you on the podcast for some time, but it's a bit timely now because you've recently put out a report, and I've read the executive summary of that report, and I understand all the work that goes into it, but can you tell us a little bit about the industrial hemp report and other reports that you put on a recurring basis and how folks might get in touch with you and or utilize those reports?
Yeah, I put all my reports on my website, whitneyeconomics.com. With respect to the industrial cannabis side of things, what I've been trying to do is I've been trying to define what the entire value chain is of hemp. And I started with cultivation, and then I've been trying to work my way up the value chain from cultivation or propagation to processing, to product manufacturing, and then on the retail side of things. There's a lot of focus right now on the retail side, but people don't understand how dependent the retail side of things is to the rest of the value chain. What I've also been trying to do is I've been trying to create a time series where I have these data points, create benchmarks and milestones, and then use that perspective over time to show where the market is going and what's going on. On the cultivation side, I just basically reached out to 10,000 people, and I got their emails directly and sent out emails to them and asked them to participate in the survey. And people were very generous with their time and with their inputs. And the results of the surveys were stunning. A majority of the, well, 65% actually of the respondents said that they didn't have a buyer for their crop. People didn't understand how to bring their product to market. People didn't have a relationship between cultivator and processor. And then they didn't know what it would take even to harvest or to scale into a commercial operation. So it was not a surprise, but what was a surprise is for the second year survey, which was published in a report in December, the cultivators that entered into the market made the same mistakes as the cultivators from the previous season. And so within the cultivation report, one of my key takeaways is to understand the value chain from seed to sale. And if you don't know where your products are going, then you're behind and you're putting your business and your farm at risk. And in the process of finishing up a processing report based upon another survey, and this time several thousand processors, and the same issues that are facing the cultivators are being faced by the processors: lack of buyer, a lack of understanding of the value chain, don't know where the product's going. And as a result, they buy these really expensive processing machines and they're underutilized. I think the utilization of the overall capacity of processing was only 42%. So when you've got these really expensive machines and they're not running full capacity, especially when I had calculated the excess in of biomass in the market at 135 million pounds, there's really no reason why those machines shouldn't be running. It's been really fascinating to see the development of the market, to understand the different perspectives. And my next step in this whole process will be to look at the product manufacturing side of things. In my opinion, the product manufacturing side that utilizes that processed material from fiber and grains, especially on the CBD side, they're impacted by these federal regulations and the murkiness thereof. It's literally costing the industry tens of billions of dollars a year in market potential. And it's giving investors pause until there's regulatory certainty. Some product manufacturers have explicitly told me that it's too risky to enter in. They're doing maybe some formulations and product development, but they're definitely not doing a major product launch into the beverage scene or the cosmetic scene or in some of these other retail markets, because they just don't know if one day they're going to be shut down by the federal government. And all this is interrelated. And until there's a bit more certainty on the industrial side of things from a federal perspective, there's going to be a lot more uncertainty and a lack of development into the market as a whole.
No, there certainly is. You're preaching to the choir here when you talk about you have to know what your buyer at least looks like. What's the profile of that buyer? What good is a license or a production facility or a cultivation facility if you don't know what the profile of your buyer is? That's been a major problem in this industry. You know what? Another major problem, I think, in the industry that really people don't get their minds around, it doesn't take that much biomass to satisfy the entire regulated commercial market. There are some of the largest CBD companies in the world, which relatively speaking to other industries are not that large, but they can produce their entire global supply on less than 50 acres worth of industrial hemp, for example, for their entire needs, for the entire global supply. It just doesn't take that much plant material to satisfy the needs if the purpose is primarily for extraction, which is why, to your point, we need to really expand those uses and look at infrastructure for the industrial uses of the plant, from plastics and so forth and so on. And that requires significant investment, significant time, significant government policies and incentives.
Yeah, Bob, I think that the difference in investing in industrial hemp is a lot of these investors have to not only invest in creating the supply, but they also have to create the demand. And because you're doing both sides of that ledger, that takes a very unique skill set from an investment perspective to develop both sides of that infrastructure. Not all of them are going to do it, and not all of them are going to be successful. But what Whitney Economics is forecasting is that there's going to be this major fundamental shift in the perspective of the cultivation requirement. We are looking at a shift over into the fiber space and into the grain space, particularly once FDA approval comes along for hemp for animal feed. And I'm forecasting that to occur within the next 12 to 24 months. And once you have animal feed the grain market can really mature and blossom. I'm also thinking, and what we're forecasting here, is that as the automobile industry transitions over into electrical vehicles, then there's going to be this tremendous opportunity for composites and fibers on the fiber side and textiles and the like, just to support the automotive industry. By 2030, we're forecasting that 7.5 to 8 million cars per year manufactured in the United States are going to have hemp in them.
The timeliness of your cultivation and processing report could not be better as we approach this 2021 growing season. And the new paradigm that you are preaching around understanding the entire value chain before putting those seeds in the ground is just critical, because the days of if you grow it, they will come, or if you build it, they will come, just don't pencil. We thank you so much for the work that you do and for sharing it with us here on the Hoban Minute. And we will make sure to highlight when that processing report does come out, that folks can go and find it on WhitneyEconomics.com. But Bo, we thank you so much for your time today and for really being a pioneer here in this new perspective, which is so desperately needed in this country to get this industry to the next level. So thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.